Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, you may have noticed that I have kind of an interest in regional cultures, and I guess that's because our country has become so homogenized that the pockets of places that retain their kind of original special culture are interesting to me. I've done shows on, for example, the Cajun country in South Louisiana. I've done a number of shows based in Appalachia and different aspects of Appalachia. And partly that's because one of our main stations is WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, which is right on the edge of the Appalachian Mountains. And by the way, you say Appalachia in Appalachia, you don't say Appalachia. And so, you know, I think of that as kind of Appalachiana when I do these shows, and this is going to be one of those. So it turns out that during the Great Depression of the 1930s, one of the programs that President Roosevelt started as part of the New Deal was the Works Progress Administration, or WPA, which employed all kinds of people from artists to historians to construction workers and put them to work doing useful things. So one project I had never heard of until recently was called the Pack Horse Library. It was a program whose mission was to deliver books by horse or mule or whatever it took to people living in the remote mountains of eastern Kentucky, again in Appalachia. The bookwomen, as they were called, braved all kinds of difficulties to get books into the hands of poor people living in Appalachia. And so from its inception in 1935 to its end in 1943, this project reached 1.5 million Kentuckians and enabled nearly 1,000 women to support themselves and their families in 48 Kentucky counties, so most of eastern Kentucky. My guest is the co-author of a book about this interesting and little-known project. The book, titled Down Cut Shin Creek by Kathy Eppelt and Jeannie Canella Schmitzer, tells the story of the Pack Horse Project. Kathy Eppelt is my guest. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you, Court. So nice to be here with you today.
Great to have you on with us. So most WPA projects involve building infrastructure, so roads, bridges, tunnels, schools, and parks, and therefore most of them employed men. Why was this particular project started?
Well, it started out of necessity, really. When the WPA was begun, its primary aim was to put men to work. But as the Depression increased and progressed and got harder and harder, it became clear that jobs for women were desperately needed. And in many cases, you know, when there was a single mother head of the household, it was needed more than ever. And so construction jobs and things like that were not deemed appropriate for women. I mean, I think there were a few women that worked on those projects. But so the government started doing things like nursing care, quilting, you know, putting women to work doing those kinds of jobs. And one of the obvious jobs for women at that time was in libraries. And so they created a system of library projects. And in Kentucky, you know, the land of horses, somebody came up with the idea of using horses to deliver books. So, yeah.
The Pack Horse Library Project, was it nationwide? It wasn't just Kentucky, was it?
It was primarily Kentucky. There were a few, as far as Jeannie and I knew, there were a few in Ohio, you know, just on the other side of the river that had delivered by horseback. I mean, there have always been mobile libraries, you know, horse-drawn wagons that had like small libraries on a cart or something. Even today, there are little libraries like in Mexico that are driven by burros. And interesting, I'll let you know that there are even camel libraries in Africa where, you know, the books are put in great big bags and carted by camels across the burning sand. Librarians, if they, you know, they'll find a way to get books out there. That was one of the big lessons that I took from working on this project, is they'll take books on boats like they did in Louisiana. They'll put books in bush planes in Alaska and deliver them. So where there's a need for a library, some industrious librarian will step up and deliver books.
Well, imagine the need was great for libraries in Appalachia, because a lot of the whole mountain chain, a lot of it was so remote. I mean, people were living in little hollows that hardly even knew their neighbors a quarter mile away, right? So I imagine right. that a high percentage of Kentuckians had no access to public libraries or books at all.
Right. And there were very few public libraries, to be honest. And, you know, some libraries, a community might have a library, but it wasn't necessarily public. It was, you know, there were private libraries or member libraries and things like that. So, yeah. So there was a real need, definitely.
So what were, in general, what were conditions like in Appalachia at the time in the Depression? Pretty bad, I'm sure.
Dire, really dire. You know, just from based from the photographs that are available from those times. And, you know, the one of the big WPA projects was putting photographers out to document the times and the people of the times. And just from taking a look at those photographs, it was pretty rough times. And Kentucky, you know, is not a huge, at least Eastern Kentucky in the mountains, it's not a great place to grow crops. So, you know, whereas in some areas, people could, if they had access to a little garden area, they could, you know, grow a few food crops for themselves or their neighbors or whatever. And that wasn't hugely true in the mountains. I mean, they could grow a few things, but not enough really to get them through the harsh winters. So it was rough. It was a lot of the people who were there working in the mines. The mines closed down, and they were without a job. And so
unemployment was even higher probably there than it was in the rest of the country. It was already sky high.
I suspect it was, yeah.
People were going hungry and probably mm-hmm. along with that, you get disease spreading and that kind of thing. So,
right.
You said, it was pretty dire. So let's switch to talking about the Pack Horse Library system. I mean, how did that work? Was there some central headquarters, or, you know, how was the whole thing run, so to speak?
In each county, they had a headquarters, and in some instances, it was a library. You know, they'd have a section where they would, or a room that they would dedicate to the Pack Horse Library, and the librarians would come in and sort through materials and then load up their bags or their saddle bags. Often they used like flour bags and things like that to carry their books in. So it could be based at a library. It might be based in a church, you know, a church basement or a community center, or maybe even a private home, where any place where they could store their materials, meet and pack themselves up, and then launch out on their trail, their daily trail. So yes, in some cases it was a library, but not always.
So I guess each one had their own route that was predetermined and that they would regularly follow, right?
Right. Each one had a couple of routes that they would go out on, and the routes tended to be 18 to 20 miles. And so in that way, they got to know their clients, you know, the people that they were delivering books to. They knew their stops, they knew their trails. You know, one of the issues that confronted the whole success of the system was that these women were considered neighbors. They were delivering books to their neighbors, to people they knew. And that way they lowered the amount of suspicion. In other words, it wouldn't have worked out for like you or me or somebody from a library school to come in and say, oh, well, we need to make sure that we get these books to these people, you know, to lower, you know, to raise their standard of living or whatever. That wouldn't have worked out. So what they did, I think, was really ingenious, is they got people from that area who knew the territory, who knew who they were, you know, who knew their neighbors, knew the constraints that they were living under, and so it took away that layer of suspicion.
Outsiderness, yeah,
right, of outsiderness. They didn't necessarily want the outside world coming in, you know, just because when a person is isolated like that, we always assume, oh, poor person, you know, they're missing out on all the benefits of society. Well, maybe so, but maybe they chose that. You know, so.
Well, I think they were proud too, and they didn't want to feel, you know, patronized or looked down
right,
on. So if you
exactly.
have somebody who's like your third cousin and has the same accent, you know, you're going to accept them much more readily than you would a graduate
exactly.
of Vassar.
Exactly. Oh, right. Yes, yeah. Exactly. And so that didn't mean that they didn't want the information or didn't, you know, weren't craving some education at all, but just the delivery of it was important. And so that was one of the ingenious aspects, I think, of the whole project, you know, is that they were neighbors serving neighbors. And so, for example, you know, the pack horse librarians would stop and chat with somebody for a while. Well, that might have been the only person that stopped by in a couple of days. So,
yeah.
You know, and the librarians, you know, they kept an eye on their clients, too, to make sure that, you know, nothing untoward was going on or that they were okay. You know, they delivered a lot of books about babies and raising kids and stuff like that. You know, hygiene books and things like that. And so they were, you know, keeping a close eye too at the same time. They were being neighbors, good neighbors.
All right. So like with them being more local people, I mean, did they need any special background or credentials? Did they have to have, you know, some college or something, or what, you know, how were they chosen in that way?
No.
Okay.
I think they just applied and, you know, if there was a spot, they were given it. And, but I mean, also they had to have either a horse or a mule.
I didn't know how to ride. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they had to know it right away, but they would have to do it pretty quickly because the librarians were responsible for having their own, providing their own horse or mule. The project didn't provide that. So, you know, they were responsible for that. So
we've been talking about, you know, them as women. Were they all women entirely?
There were a few men. There were actually a few men. So, yeah. Not many, though. It was primarily women. Jeannie and I think we uncovered maybe three men, but there may have been more.
How much were they paid?
A whopping $28 a month, which didn't go far, I'm sure. And out of that, they had to provide for the horse. Some, like we interviewed one woman, Grace Lucas, who had been one of the librarians, and she rented her horse, and his name was Bill, for 50 cents a month. But she had to pay for all his food and, you know, upkeep. So, yeah, so the $28 a month wasn't strictly for Grace and her colleagues to take home. So it was a hard job for not much.
Yeah, but imagine $28 a month in those days. I think I did a quick calculation, actually. I think it's about $500 equivalent in today's dollars. So, you know, which is still not much, but if nobody around you has a job and you're a woman who has even fewer chances of having a job, it's pretty good. I think, you know, you can survive on it probably in those days. Right. So,
Grace Lucas, the woman that Jeannie and I interviewed, we were so lucky to interview her, by the way. She not only, well, her first husband, left, you know, to find a job and left her there with kids, and her mother was also living with them. She wound up fostering, I don't know how many children, lots of children. So they were, she had a lot of mouths to feed on $28 a month, but even $500, you know, with so many kids would not go far.
Today, yeah.
Yeah.
So the other thing I read is that salaries for the librarians and their supervisors were the only thing supported by the federal government under the WPA. So how were the books themselves brought and who paid for them?
Well, a lot of the books were donations. You know, people would clean out their bookshelves or whatever and donate them. Largely, one of the big things that happened is that the PTAs across Kentucky came up with a penny fund to fund materials, but also the federal government loved this project. They, you know, there was something romantic, I guess, about women traipsing around in the mountains delivering books, you know, via horseback. And so they propagandized it in a way to let people know that the WPA was, in fact, working. It was doing good things. And so people across the country shipped books to them, you know, or they would, if they were driving, for, let's say, from Florida to DC or something, they would stop off in Kentucky and unload their old magazines and books for the library project. But it was a constant issue was keeping materials. For one thing, because they were carting them around on the back of horses in flour bags, they got pretty bunged up, you know, and just from usage, books don't last forever. Sure. And so one of the things that they did to offset that is when they met, one of the things they do is kind of scavenge the books and magazines that they had, and they'd make scrapbooks. And, you know, from bits and pieces, you know, they wouldn't let a book just die, you know, and bury it. They would tear out the pages that they could use and, you know, or rebind it or something, you know, to keep it in circulation as long as they could. So they were very crafty in that way. The other thing that these scrapbooks had, which is really interesting to me, is that for a lot of people, you know, when the librarian would show up on their doorstep and say, here are these books that we're going to let you have for the next 2 weeks when I come back again, no cost, absolutely free, you know, just read them, use them, and then I'll pick them up and give you some others. You know, they were kind of greeted with a suspicion or let's just say, they didn't want to be seen as going on the dole or taking something, you know, that wasn't earned. And so the kind of a code of the mountains is to, you know, return, you know, give back. And so the clients would give recipes or quilt patterns or, you know, write up little stories and things like that to put in these scrapbooks. And there, a couple of them were saved and presented to Eleanor Roosevelt. And they're now in the library in Hyde Park, New York. So you can actually see, you know, one of these wonderful scrapbooks, you know, and turn its pages and look at the things that they collected, you know, from the clientele themselves. So it was joyful in that regard, you know, this kind of give and take.
Yeah, we hope that more than a couple of them are saved, because they probably are kind of little, you know, cultural vignettes of what life was like back then. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know how many survived. I'm sure there's some in somebody's attic somewhere. There might be one at one of the county libraries. So,
you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Kathy Eppelt, who's the author of a book about a thing called the Packhorse Library, which was back in the 30s and early 40s, was a project of the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. And she wrote a book with a co-author called Down Cutshin Creek about this topic that we're talking about, which was librarians on horseback and muleback going out into remote sections of the Appalachian Mountains to basically be mobile bookmobiles, early bookmobiles for people who were really isolated back there and wanted something to read. So we talked about their route earlier, Kathy. You said they covered 18 to 20 miles, I think, a day. Mm-hmm. But you know, these were no paved roads. I mean, sometimes not even a trail. They're walking down a creek bed or something to avoid having to walk through forest. And so,
right.
So did they, I mean, I guess you can go 18 to 20 miles in one day, but did they come back home at the end of the day, or did they continue on a route? You know, how did they stay overnight, routes, or what did they do?
Yeah, the routes would largely be circular. So, you know, they could make it back home. They largely tried to make it back home, unless they had a relative that they could stay with. If the weather, for example, was extreme and they just had to find a place to stay, they would impose upon a, or not impose, that's not a good word to use. They would ask, you know, one of their patrons if they could stay over. Mm-hmm. They were reluctant to do that because often if there were children.
It's a one-bedroom cabin.
Right, it's one bedroom. And if they were to stay, the the host would be obligated to feed them. And that might mean less for the children, or, sure, you know, because they would, as a guest, they would be fed first. That's another code of the mountain, kind of unwritten code of hospitality in the mountains. And, you know, so the librarians were always reluctant to stop over if they didn't have to. So for the most part, they tried to make it home. And I think the routes were largely circular, so they could, you know, head out and then make their way back in. So they weren't a straight line away from their library. So, yeah, there, when we were, when Jeannie and I were working on this, we spent a lot of time in Frankfort at the archives in Kentucky, in the state archives. And they have a lot of original materials there, a lot of reports. They would, you know, type up reports and send them into Washington and whatnot. And there was one report that we were reading where one of the librarian's mule, she was on a mule, and the mule just dropped dead under her, no, you know, oh just gosh, like, sorry, sayonara, bam, I'm out of here, enough of this, you know.
And, jump.
Yeah. And so she, until she could procure another mule, actually walked her route, you know, for the time being. She finished, of course, she finished that day, but but wow, for a couple of days, a couple of weeks, I think she walked a route, and they reported that in, you know. So that's how dedicated these people were, you know, that they would walk. I don't know if I could walk 18 to 20 miles in a day. I'm sure she must have broken up that
steep hills, up steep hills, yeah, through woods and everything, yes, else. Yeah, sure.
But they used animal paths, you know, for trails or fence lines. They rode along fence lines. They used a lot of creeks. That's why we called it Down Cutchin Creek, because they used the creeks, the creek bed, as trails. So yeah.
What kind of books were the most popular, like with kids in particular, and also with adults if they could read, right? So what was there,
right,
different types of books that were more in demand than others?
Picture books were always in demand. Mm. Because so many people couldn't read, a considerable percentage of the population couldn't read. Mm-hmm. And picture books, you know, picture books make it easier to figure out the language, the written word, because the illustrations support the text.
Sure.
So those were always in demand for kids and for adults. Kentucky, you know, along with some other states, was very progressive as far as trying to educate its population. They also had what are called moonlight classrooms. And what those were after dark on full moon nights, a teacher would hold class for adults who couldn't read, and they'd do them on these moonlight, you know, these full moon nights where they had some light to travel by. So for 4 or 5 nights out of the month, when there was enough moonlight to shed for walking, they would hold class for adults who wanted to read. So so there were other programs going on simultaneously with the pack horse libraries, you know, in the service of their population. And but the other thing that they distributed a lot of were things like Popular Mechanics magazine, Better Homes and Gardens, you know, magazines that could be helpful, and, you know, talked about tools and health issues and things like that. So there was always a big yearning for those kind of materials.
I imagine that Bibles were high on the list too.
I think so. Most homes had a Bible, and so I'm sure they distributed them, but I can't say for sure that it was the number one thing that they distributed. I imagine the churches provided some of those.
Okay.
That's just a guess.
Were there types of reading material that they weren't allowed to distribute?
Yes. Things like modern romance were not welcome. Sci-fi, things like that. You know, there was some curating, you know, which was, I mean, it's always appropriate, I think, to curate to a certain extent. I can't say that they were banning books or material at all. I don't think that was the case. But you know, they just knew what their clientele were interested in, and they tried to provide that. I'm not saying that like some teenager didn't want to crack at Modern Romance magazine.
Sure. You didn't get a chance.
Yeah. And I'm sure there was some, you know, some discernment about what they were putting out there. But for the most, they, you know, they tried to keep it just kind of general information.
Yeah, you know, very conventional and uncontroversial, and they didn't want to start right. any kind of arguments or
right. You know. I doubt they were distributing Lady Chatterley's Lover.
pretty sure they weren't. Yeah. So yeah, you
that
mentioned
doesn't mean they weren't reading it.
So you mentioned the one woman who had her horse or mule die out from under her, but mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they had, you know, not only bad weather where sudden storms would come up, but bears and so on. I mean, snakes.
Oh, yeah.
Did any of them ever get seriously injured that you know of?
You know,
into serious trouble where they really were kind of in a life-threatening situation one way or another?
I think all of them, probably any of them that rode out in the winter experienced, you know, some troubles, you know, either a horse fell out from under them or, you know, just crossing the creek, being frostbitten from the ice and snow. I'm sure they... you know, encountered, I'm sure all of them encountered some dangerous, you know, obstacles or problems in their work. I think it would be pure luck to not have something happen, you know, out there.
So Kathy, we just have a minute or so left, but just briefly, how and why did the project end in, I think, 1943? What happened?
World War II happened, and a lot of these projects were closed down because jobs opened up in the war industries, and especially for women, they closed down. So, you know, the government felt like they were not that needed anymore. But I, you know, I have to say, and the librarians really, you know, made their mark, and you know, where library service had not ever been available, they provided service, and as a result, there are county libraries where there were no county libraries, and so yeah,
good,
they're heroes.
Well, we're gonna have to leave it there. It's been very interesting, and so there are a couple of books on this subject. I mentioned Down Cut Chin Creek, and the subtitle is The Pack Horse Librarians of Kentucky by our guest Kathy Appelt, APPELT, and her co-author, Jeannie Canella Schmitzer. And another one is the book, it's actually called The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek, by Kim Michelle Richardson. So those two both are very interesting books on this subject.
There's a picture book by a Kentucky author, Heather Henson, called That Bookwoman, that is illustrated by David Small, that is a wonderful picture book about the project. And then there's another one coming out in 26 by Caroline Rose, and it's called Books Up the Mountain, which I love that title. So you'll have to be on the lookout for that one.
Well, I guess a lot of people find this interesting in the same way I did when it popped up one day on my phone. And so I'd never heard of it. So now a lot of other people have heard of it, right? I want to thank you, Kathy, for being on with us on American Variety Radio.
Thank you, Court. It was a joy.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.